Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Carthage College, inviting you to become part of the studio audience for the last Beyond the Beltway nationally syndicated radio program to air before the election. The program is going to be produced at the Neiman Media Theater at Carthage this coming Sunday night. Email rsvp@carthage.edu to attend. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tonight on Milwaukee Channel 10 and on PBS stations across the country, a riveting documentary is going to be airing on the PBS series American Experience. The documentary is entitled The Battle of Chosin, and it is an examination of a very, very crucial battle during the Korean conflict. It occurred in 1950, and it was a battle which was in many respects very, very significant for what unfolded in American history from that point on. It really helped underscore the need for America to strengthen its military and be prepared to repel what were thought to be the rising threats of communism in various parts of the globe. And in some respects, that need, that issue, really came to a head in this critical battle of Chosin, which also found American fighting men in desperately difficult conditions, in freezing cold in northern Korea, cut off from supplies and dramatically outnumbered by Chinese troops who were attacking them. It's a dramatic story, and I suspect many Americans like me knew next to nothing about it. Maybe just knew the name Battle of Chosin, but had no idea what in fact unfolded. My morning show guest knows about the Battle of Chosin because he was there. I'm very pleased and honored to be speaking today on the morning show with a veteran by the name of Grant McMillan, who enlisted in 1950, and he actually ended up being captured and for 32 months was a prisoner of war during the Korean conflict. So and he happens to be one of a number of veterans who are part of the documentary that is airing tonight. Mr. McMillan makes his home now in Elkhorn, so he was happy and willing to make the trip over to our WGTD studios to join me for this conversation, so we could hear from him firsthand his experiences in Korea and in the Battle of Chosin. Grant McMillan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
So at some point, the United States becomes embroiled in this conflict involving Korea, North and South Korea, and the conflict between those two nations along their 38th parallel. And one of the things that is said in this documentary, The Battle of Chosin, airing tonight, is that there were plenty of young men who were actually excited to go because they had, in a sense, missed out on the excitement of World War II. Or, I mean, that's in their own naive way, that's how they kind of saw it. And they were eager to have, I suppose, in a sense, like a taste of glory and thought mm-hmm. that's what they were going to be experiencing more than anything. If they were shipped off to Korea. Do you remember feeling anything like that in terms of being shipped off to Korea? Were you approaching this experience with that kind of excited anticipation?
Well, at the time that the Korean War started, I was going to school in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And four of us went back to Texas and volunteered to go. It sounded like our troops on the ground were getting mauled pretty badly by the North Koreans. And they had a big, well-armed unit. But I was told I was not going to Korea, that I had got too much money invested in me and too much schooling, so I would be training people to go. Mm. And that's why I came home and to Lake Geneva and bought a car and drove it back to Fort Sill. As soon as the school was over that I graduated from, I went back to Texas, drove the car down there. And the first sergeant the next couple of days came in, and I was asleep yet. And he jumped on my back and said, "How would you like to sell your car?" I said, "Sergeant, I just bought that car." And he said, "Well, where you're going, you need a tank. You don't need a car."
That's what he said?
Yep.
Wow. And that's how you knew you were headed off to Korea.
Right.
So you were, aside from the fact that you no longer needed the car you just bought, it sounds like you were excited to go.
Oh, I was ready. Yeah.
One of the things that is spelled out in this in the documentary airing tonight is how General Douglas MacArthur, who was in charge of our operations there in Korea, had very audacious plans. He wanted American forces to, in a sense, slice their way through North Korea all the way to whatever that river is that forms the northern boundary of North Korea.
The Yellow River.
The Yellow River. And that, and as far as he could tell from the great success that was being enjoyed, he thought that was going to be no problem to go all the way there. In other words, take over the entire country. I mean, bring North Korea to its knees, right. and that was his plan. Of course, it really didn't work out that way, did it?
No, and part of it was that MacArthur had talked a lot about keeping or bringing in the nationalist Chinese from Taiwan to fight in Korea, and the Chinese, of course, did not want that, because that was another stab in the back for them. And they brought in volunteers, they called them.
Right, and many, many, many thousands, and the situation changes drastically. Let me reintroduce you. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Grant McMillan. He is a veteran who now lives in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. He's come to our studios today to talk about his experience as a participant in what was known as the Battle of Chosin, which is the subject of a documentary airing tonight on PBS in the series American Experience. This was a hard-fought battle over the course of 2 weeks. During the course of it, as a matter of fact, Grant McMillan was imprisoned. So when you got to Korea, where were you dispatched? I mean, where did you go first?
We went in behind the Marines one day later at Incheon. And they went towards Seoul, and we went south.
And we should say Incheon was where the Marines scored quite a decisive victory, or seemed right. to score a very decisive victory. And that's part of what fueled General MacArthur's sense that this country is just ripe for the taking, and
right.
and sent him forth then.
Yeah, he went when Seoul fell to the American Army and the Marines, he immediately went past the 38th parallel. And a lot of the people had gone to the 38th and stopped, because we weren't allowed really to go in, according to the UN, into North Korea.
Right.
We were just supposed to kick them out of South Korea.
Right. But General MacArthur had this idea of let's plunge the sword right into the heart of North Korea itself. So explain to our listeners this name of Chosin, Chosin, by which this crucial battle is known.
Well, there was a large reservoir in North Korea named the Changjin Reservoir. It was on the Changjin River. And when the Japanese took over Korea, which they had taken many years before, the Koreans were not allowed to use their own language. Everything was in the schools was made to give them Japanese education, and they changed a lot of the names in the country. The one was the Changjin Reservoir became the Chosin Reservoir.
So you are part of this fighting force that plunges into the heart of North Korea. And this is late 1950. This is November of 1950. And it is tremendously cold and also very desolate landscape and very difficult conditions in which to travel. Just try to describe for us, first of all, just how cold it was and how difficult this terrain was to travel upon.
Well, with the 7th Division, which I was with, we went to Busan in the south part of Korea and got on ships and went up the east coast and went back in again at Iwan. If we'd gone much farther, we'd have been in Vladivostok. Hmm. But we went up in the mountains, and we didn't meet any opposition. It was very cold, and I was riding in a 3/4-ton truck, and I got out every few minutes and ran beside the truck to warm up.
Hmm.
Our division had no winter gear.
Really?
We had field jackets and a pile liner for it. And we had not seen any winter clothing until we passed through the Marines on the way to the Chosin Reservoir.
Hmm. So as is described in this documentary tonight, the American forces charge into the heart of North Korea, seem to meet very, very little opposition whatsoever from any North Koreans, and it seems like it's going to be the easiest thing in the world. But unbeknownst to the Americans, unanticipated certainly by American leadership, mainland China enters the fray, and they send in tens of thousands of soldiers, but in a way that's quite surreptitious, often at night, walking through forests and so on. I mean, so it's as though you guys didn't even know that they were there. So explain how the Chinese first make their presence known, and at what point it became clear that you guys, in fact, were in trouble instead of riding to triumph.
We went in on the eastern shore of the reservoir. There was a bridge in front of us that crossed the river that was going into the reservoir. And our infantry had crossed that bridge and gone north, the 32nd Infantry Regiment. There was, our guns were right at the end of the bridge, and the headquarters battery that I was with was a mile down the road, down the railroad tracks. And we replaced the Marines, and they pulled out late in the afternoon and said that they had patrols out and seen no one. By the morning, the next morning, our guns had been lost. The Chinese had overrun those guns, and they were coming to take us. There was about 200 of us in the battery I was with. And we pushed them back, jumped in the trucks, and went up to our guns. And by then, our troops had taken them back in the light of day.
So these were like guns kind of on your perimeter, guarding
right.
Your perimeter, and the Chinese were able to encroach far enough to take control of those guns.
They took control of two batteries, and we were short one battery that hadn't got there, and our service battery had not come up with us. So we had in total about maybe 2,500 guys with a few South Koreans, Katusu they called them, Koreans attached to the United States Army.
Hmm.
And I had one assigned to me, and he was carrying a carbine. I found that carbine in the hands of some Chinese later.
Hmm.
But he had given up his carbine to take over a 2.36 self-propelled, anyway.
So did you have any idea how many Chinese troops were out there as part of this attack?
No.
I mean, it became evident, at least later, that you were vastly outnumbered, right?
Yes. As it turns out, we were outnumbered almost 10 to 1.
Yeah. And so here you are in the middle of North Korea, and General MacArthur's assumption was that there's going to be no opposition. This is going to be the easiest victory ever, and very radically, the picture changes, and you realize that you are in a sense cut off from your supply lines in a very inhospitable environment, to say the least, and drastically outnumbered by Chinese soldiers all around you. I mean, it ends up being quite a desperate situation. So describe from there what happened to you and the men you were with.
Well, we were surrounded, and the Chinese fought mainly at night. They would come in and they were trying to knock out our Twin 40 and Quad 50s that were with our 15th AAA, which is anti-aircraft. But there was no aircraft to fire at, and they were firing ground support. The Chinese wanted to knock those guns out because the Twin 40s and Quad 50s are devastating to a group. And they fought their way up to us, and we got on the trucks and made it up to the guns then. And for 4 days, we held out. The dead were piled up on the field that we were at and left there when we did pull out the fifth day. Most of the fighting, like I say, was at night. And the fourth night, some lieutenants told seven of us to sit down in a little hole, like, in the ground. And wait, because if the Chinese broke through the perimeter, he was going to send us in to push them back out and hold until we got help.
Wow.
Well, we knew that there was no help coming, that we would have to hold. And must have been 10 o'clock at night, and nice and dark, and except for the false light you get from snow on the ground.
Yeah.
And he came around and yelled, they broke through I Company, and we have to run across the field and up and push the Chinese out and hold the line. Well, I was running across that field when I got hit. A bullet had gone into the front of my foot and came out in the ankle. And it knocked me down. So I laid there on the ground and waited, and this lieutenant came by, and I said, "Lieutenant, I'm hit, but I'm fit to fire. Do you want me to stay here for fire effect or help, or do you want me just to leave?" He said, "If you can get back to the aid station, go back." So I crawled and walked and whatever I could back to the aid station. And a sergeant came out, said, I have nobody to help you. If you get any help, it'll be helping yourself."
Wow.
So I took my boot off and looked at, in the snow, you could see, and it looked like I had a hole the size of a 50-cent piece coming out the side of my foot.
Mm.
But I took my sulfa powder and put some on there and tried to bandage it a little bit, and then I couldn't get my boot back on. It had swollen too much. So I took the extra pair of socks that I had in my pocket, put that on that foot, and went back to the guns and helped with those.
Wow. Went back to fight.
Right.
Wow. We should mention this matter of help not coming. There's a moment in the documentary that is really, really disturbing when some sort of military official is choppered in. I don't remember if that's to your site or to someplace else, but basically choppered in, and you are hoping that this is a signal that help is on the way, and that's what you're going to be told. But you weren't told that. In fact, they did not seem, back at headquarters, they did not seem to properly understand how desperate your situation was and how desperately you needed reinforcements and needed help. Why do you think that was? Have you ever been able to figure out why they were, in a sense, so clueless to your situation, to your circumstances, and unwilling to try to send in help?
I'm not so sure that they were clueless. I think that they knew, because the Army tried to get rid of us. I mean, just transfer us to the Marines, attach us to the Marines, and that lets the Army generals off the hook. And the Marines didn't want us because O.P. Smith did not like the Army.
Ah, he was a Marine.
Right, he's a Marine general. So that between the two of them, we were in limbo.
Mm.
We were getting some flights to drop ammunition and food to us, but it was many times the wrong ammunition.
That's right. They say that they would drop ammunition and it wouldn't fit the guns that you had.
Right.
So completely useless ammunition then.
Right.
Oh, it had to be so maddening, I mean, to experience something so frightening, and then on top of it, to not be receiving even the most basic sort of help and assistance that would have helped you to repel the attack of the Chinese at least a bit more effectively.
Right.
It's actually kind of amazing to me that you were able to repel their attacks as effectively as you were, given the fact that you were so outnumbered. Was it that they were outgunned? I mean, did you have better weapons they did or better training? I mean, how was it that you were able to hold out as well as you did?
We had better equipment, I think. Most of our equipment was World War II equipment, which the Chinese had too. The Chinese also had a lot of Japanese weapons, and I think that probably saved my foot. Because I think I was probably hit with the Japanese 25. Our 30 calibers would have done a lot more damage.
Well, eventually, after 4 or 5 days, an order is given for you to pull out. Where did that order come from?
That came from Colonel Faith.
So he was your commander right there on site.
Yes.
And I suppose he made the decision that you guys couldn't hold out any longer.
Well, the decision was made at night that we would go the next morning. And we loaded in trucks the next morning, the fifth day. And I was put in the back of a truck because I was wounded. But the truck sat there because the skies were bad, not much light, and it was snowing a little bit. And we sat there until after 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And finally started to fight our way out. One of the first things was that all the guys that were holding the Chinese back jumped up and ran to the convoy that was sitting in the road. And one of our planes came in, saw that rush of humanity, and dropped a napalm on them.
On the Chinese, except...
Except it was on our guys.
Yes, so it's kind of a case of tragic friendly fire, so
right.
To speak. Before we move ahead, I think one thing that is a little hard to understand is the way in which this was a battle or in the way in which this was an attack, because I think sometimes we still, when we think about attacks in wartime and battles in wartime, we think of things that have very cleanly delineated battle lines, and the enemy's over here and we're over here and then we clash in the middle, and this wasn't that kind of warfare. In some ways, it sounds a bit more like guerrilla warfare, where you wouldn't know exactly where the enemy was. Is that right? Is that a fair description?
Something like that, yes, because the Chinese were all around us. We were absolutely surrounded. The nearest help would have been the Marines 8 miles away. And we had to fight our way down these roads and over the mountains for 8 miles to get help from the Marines. We had to go to them.
Right.
And that didn't work out real well.
Right. So not long after your departure, this plane trying to help ends up dropping napalm on some of these
right.
American troops with, of course, tragic results. Tell us what happens from there.
Well, the truck I was on, our convoy of trucks moved down to where we had set up the first night when we got there, and which was about a mile. The Chinese had blown a bridge on the road, so we had no way to go except with the trucks into the swamp, which was frozen pretty good, but not good enough to get trucks through. So we had those twin 40s that were tracked vehicles, and like a tank. Hmm. So they could hook onto the front of a truck and pull it through that swamp. So they pulled trucks through the swamp, and they broke through into the water sometimes. But they got us across around the bridge and up the hill. Well, some of our guys then had gone, because our radios were not made to talk to the Marines. Those were Marine planes that were coming in.
Mm.
And our guys had taken Hill 1221, which is, designates the height. And they took over an old Marine location there that had some foxholes dug. But the planes came in and strafed them up there,
not realizing that it was Americans.
Right.
And you didn't have the right sort of radio frequencies in order to communicate with
them.
We
couldn't communicate with them. We had that radio, and we had a Marine to operate it, a captain. But he couldn't make the thing work.
Hmm.
And I don't know what was wrong with it, but he was trying to make the radio work when I was sitting right in the truck beside him.
Wow. So you're not only trying to repel the attack from the Chinese all around you, but then you're also sustaining damage and casualty
fire, yeah.
From friendly fire, so to speak, from the Marines. So it's just about as desperate a situation as one can possibly imagine.
Well, we got across the bridge anyway and started up the hill, and there were two truckloads of wounded. I was in the cab of the truck by then because I had got out of the back. You can't fire from the back of a truck like that. And I got out, went with the driver, and someone got into the front seat beside me. And we were about halfway up the hill to what they called a hairpin curve. And the Chinese had blocked the road at that point, because you got to slow way down to make the curve and back up the mountain and over it. And they, about halfway up there, was a tank knocked out in the side of the road. And we went in the ditch, and two trucks, one ahead of us and then mine, I was in, stopped in the ditch there. And the driver got out and left. I'm not sure what happened to the truck or what.
Like if he just got frightened or something? Or
I don't know if there was something wrong with this truck. I have no idea. But they left two trucks
just right there where they were, and blocking everybody behind them then.
Well, everybody else could go by. And we were the last couple trucks anyway. So.
Right.
So they just left us. And they went up to the hairpin curve, and I could hear the screaming and shooting up there. But and push them over the side and stuff like that, because they were getting any trucks that were knocked out, pushed off the side of the mountain. But we sat in the two truckloads we had, and I was walking around in the middle of the road with the first sergeant. Stein, I think his name was. And he came over and was talking to me. He said, "I'm thinking about surrendering, because the Chinese don't keep any of the wounded. They let them go and keep only the able-bodied." And I said, "Sergeant, you better make up your mind very fast, because the Chinese are right there."
Mm.
And by then we knew it was Chinese we were facing. So, And they came into the road almost immediately when he walked out with a white handkerchief.
So that was the decision then: we need to surrender. There's
right.
No possibility.
The only way to save us. And I think that there were probably 10 of us that could walk. The rest of the guys in the trucks couldn't. So those were machine gunned.
Oh, just right then and there.
Yeah, that was ended right away. And the 10 of us were taken down the road a little ways and made to kneel in a ditch. And we knew we were going to get shot. And up the road came a guy with I thought it was a white towel wrapped around his head. It turned out it was like a white turban. And later I found out that what he was a commissar with the Chinese troops. And he talked to the soldiers up behind us with Thompson submachine guns and told them something, and they came down into the road and they got us out of the ditch and headed us north.
Hmm. So something was said. You have no idea what,
I couldn't understand right. Chinese at
but
all.
But your lives were spared. So where were you taken then?
We were taken back through the area that we had just left and up a little valley into a bigger valley, and there were a couple of big, like, barn structures there where they were holding prisoners, and we were put in there. One of our planes came over, and a guy ran out and waving his arms and everything, and, of course, it came in and strafed the barn then. And when the guy right beside me caught a 50 caliber machine gun bullet in the head, so.
Wow. So are we talking about hundreds or thousands of Americans that are part of this group of prisoners?
Well, it got more and more. They took us up a little side valley, and the first sergeant came over because they were going to try to escape, and he said, I know you can't run, so your job is to kill that guard.
Told you?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I went down to the stream coming out of the mountain and had a drink, and then I'd get a little closer to the guard, and I probably got 6 or 8 feet from him, sat down on a rock. And up the valley came the Chinese, a bunch of Chinese, with these big iron pots that you see in decoration in people's yards and stuff.
Yeah.
They had two of those. One of them was full of, like, fried potatoes, fried sliced, and the other one was beans boiled up. And they gave us food. Hmm. And everybody forgot about escaping because the food that we had to fight the Chinese to get it because it was dropped to us. And the parachutes carried it up the mountain, so we had to go up and drag it back.
Right, under
the Chinese fire.
Right, absolutely. And here you were being fed. You were just being brought food. You didn't have to go foraging for it on the hillside.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting because one of the things that's talked about in the documentary is how the Chinese soldiers, in some respects, were even in more desperate need than you guys were in terms of not having proper clothing, not having proper food, not having proper weapons. I mean, there were many, many, many more of them.
Right.
But that's the only advantage that they had.
Right. They had tennis shoes. Hmm. At least we had boots.
Right.
And they were many times froze to death in the fields at night, staying quiet. And they would freeze to death, and they'd find just a mound of snow the next day.
Right. So you were kept in these sort of barn-like structures, and you were free to move about otherwise?
Well, we were told to set along the walls in these structures, but then they took us out and up the valley a ways, and we were put in like a Korean house. And they have the fireplace to cook over is in one end of the house, but it's below ground level. And then the fire evacuates up underneath the floor to heat the stones that they put in, and then up the chimney the other end. Hmm. So it's right like radiant heat. Your feet stay nice and warm in those places if they got a fire going.
Right. So that was one of your first times you were probably warm in quite a while.
Well, but they didn't run those stoves all the time because our planes were looking for smoke coming out of chimneys.
Ah.
And they strafed those. But one of our planes had gone up probably to bomb the dam at the end of the reservoir and had one 500-pounder left, so he just dropped it on the house we were in. Hmm. Missed the house just a little ways, but the whole end of the house came in, and it killed the first sergeant and four other guys that we dug out, but it was too late for them.
Wow. So in a situation like this, is there any sense of rank? I mean, and is there somebody who, in a sense, kind of takes charge of all of... I mean, an American who kind of takes charge of all of you as prisoners, or are you just sort of... at that point, kind of all on an even playing field, so to speak?
I think we're pretty much on an even playing field. Because when I was going away from those trucks and stuff that were knocked out, we all were walking. I couldn't keep up with it. But the Chinese soldier that was guarding those other guys would stop. He'd walk them, and if I got too far behind, he stopped them, and they waited until I caught up, and then they started walking again.
Wow. You probably feel fortunate that your life was spared, because I should think at some point you were afraid that they might decide you weren't worth the trouble.
Right. Wow. And that happened a lot of times. At least I've been told that guys would fall back and the Chinese would eventually shoot them and take off.
So how many different places did you end up being over the course of, it's actually 32 months that you remained a prisoner? I mean, I suppose you lost count after a while.
Well, we went to what we called Death Valley. The Army called it Valley 1. And there were probably 300 of us held in that valley. After being there until the spring, we were moved to a camp along the Yalu River called Kangi. And they would take only those people that could walk 85 miles, because it was 85 miles from Death Valley.
Wow.
And we hiked up there, and one of our reunions after I got back, I mentioned the fact that they had a cogged railroad track to take us up the side of a mountain. The other guys didn't remember that, except for a couple. And they remembered that the Chinese had actually put us in that car and had us hauled up there.
Like a train car. Yeah.
Right. And did that, send us up the side of that mountain in that.
Right. I should think one of the things that was especially frightening about being taken prisoner is the fact that you had to know at least something about how horrifically the Japanese had treated prisoners of war. I mean, just the brutality of how they treated prisoners is just really hard to even fathom, hard to take in. Of course, you weren't imprisoned by the Japanese, you were imprisoned by the Chinese, but I should think just the fact of sort of being in that part of the world that you had to wonder what kind of treatment you were going to receive at the hand of your Chinese captors. Overall, what was that treatment like?
Well, the Chinese turned out to be quite generous. They turned us over to the North Koreans for a while. And we didn't have any food during the time that the North Koreans took over. They wouldn't give us anything. The Chinese did what they could. There's always been a lot of talk about not following Geneva Conventions. But the Chinese had no doctors to give us medical care. What they carried on their back was what they ate. So they didn't have any food. And eventually they took us back over, and they got from the Koreans potatoes, and we were allowed to boil potatoes and gave in the morning before dawn and one after dark. One potato, some of them were rotten, but you ate them because they're better than nothing.
Right. How would you spend your time, all of the time, I mean, all day long, for instance? What would you and your fellow prisoners do?
Well, most of the time, I was busy. And so were a couple other guys.
Busy doing what?
Getting the food and getting water to boil the food. And stuff like that.
Oh, so you were responsible for the cooking.
Well, some of this stuff we had to do.
I see.
And the Chinese took care of the cooking and that, but we had to go get the water from the creek and haul it into the kitchen. And so we stayed fairly busy.
Was this just something you volunteered to do?
Yeah, it just happened that I was there. They
pointed at you.
Well, I was just there, and somebody needed to do it, so we three did it.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the guys, a lot of them, well, I don't say a lot, a few of them were not wounded even, but they didn't help us. They were helping themselves.
Mm. So you had a good spirit of trying to make the best of it.
Yeah.
Did you have any sense of what was going on in the outside world? Any notion whatsoever of how America was doing in this Korean conflict?
Not really. the Chinese told us that they had gone and taken Seoul, and I guess they had, and it got taken back and a couple of times. But up at that time, we had no idea. They took us up to Kangi, and then we were destined to be released. So they took us over to the railroad going north and south, and we rode the trains south almost to the front lines. Wow. And then the front lines had settled into a bunker-type war, and the Chinese turned us around and took us back to a town up near Sinuiju, which is a border on the Yalu River and the border between Korea and China.
Right. So you were a long, long way from friendly territory at that point.
Oh, yeah.
How much English did you ever hear from your Chinese captors? I mean, I would guess most of them didn't speak any English whatsoever.
Well, we had the volunteers, and that, I guess they were given a choice to either volunteer or get shot. But they were nationalist Chinese, and they had been with the Marines at some time or other, and some of them learned a little bit of English. We had a Chinese captain that came in and took over control of our 200 guys. And he had his interpreter talk to us. He spoke everything in Chinese. And in a couple weeks, I guess, he went around with his hands behind his back and walked around, and guys called him all kinds of filthy names and everything like that. But I don't know if someone got under his skin or what was going on. But he suddenly talked and turned around and pointed at the guy, and he said, "Listen, USOB, I speak better English than you do. My degree is from Cambridge. Where's yours from?" And it really settled everything down.
I should think in a moment.
But wow. The British, we had, when we set up in that town, there were 800 GIs there. In Death Valley, we probably had 300 in and 100 out. So a couple hundred guys were left there. But in the Camp One, they called it, in this town, were 800 GIs and 600 British. The British 600 guys were on the line, had South Korean troops on each side of them. We left at night, and the Chinese took their place. So they woke up in the morning, and they're completely surrounded. So the commander surrendered those 600 guys, and they were all brought into camp, to Camp One together. But we were not allowed to talk to them or anything. And in fact, we couldn't talk to the 200 guys in the next American group. They kept us separated and everything for quite a while, and they took all the officers out, shipped them to another camp, so that we had no chain of command.
Wow. How fearful were you that you were not going to live to return home?
I think probably all of us got to a point where we knew we weren't going home. The war was lasting and lasting, and the reason for it were not good reasons, I don't think, but the Chinese kept us up to date on what was happening. And the instant that the armistice was signed, they told us, "You're going home. We'll have trucks here tomorrow for you."
And did they?
Yes.
Wow. So 32 months after that day that you were part of that surrender, you were brought home. So tell us about that journey. Where were you taken and under what circumstances?
Well, during the morning, we were loading everybody on trucks to go back to the front lines to be exchanged. And the Chinese came around and said, you, and you are staying. So the three of us were pulled off to the side to stay.
While everybody else gets to leave.
Gets in the trucks, yep. And what's going on? Well, then they came over and told us, the Red Cross wants to see what kind of houses you're living in or what you're doing.
Where you had been kept.
Right. and they will be here. And it's almost instantaneous. The choppers were there. The Red Cross got out, gave us toothbrushes and toothpaste, and which we didn't need because we already had it from the Chinese. And they brought us one Hershey bar, so that we hadn't had.
Right.
But they immediately walked out, looked around, got back in the helicopters, and flew away.
Hmm.
So this Chinese captain came over, and he said, "Can you guys fit in that Jeep?" You bet.
If it means going home, yes.
And he says, "I can catch that convoy because they won't be going very fast, and I'll get you on a truck."
Mm-hmm.
So he did. He took us up, and we caught the convoy and were put on the last truck.
Wow. That sounds like an almost friendly exchange there at the end. Is that? Did it feel like a friendly exchange?
Yeah. Yeah, they were keeping us up to date pretty well and everything. The Chinese, I think we got along pretty well with the Chinese.
Hmm.
Well, in fact, when we first got taken over there to Camp One, the Chinese guards challenged us to a basketball game.
Really?
And they beat the devil out of us because we weren't in any kind of shape. When we finally got better food and we started getting some exercising and stuff like that, we challenged them to a game. And we did return favor.
Did a little better the second time around.
Yes.
So for as horrific as some of Korea was, it's a bit of a surprise that, in fact, this, and we probably shouldn't paint too rosy a picture of it, but compared to the prisoner of war experiences that, that so many suffer through in the Second World War, I mean, certainly in the Vietnam War as well, we just hear the most horrible kinds of stories. You're fortunate that your prisoner of war story is at least not that.
Right. And I apologize. I was going to bring in a book because I got one from somehow I got a book sent to me about the Olympics that we had in North Korea in 1952.
Hmm.
About a little over maybe 16 months after we were captured, we had an Olympics all at Camp 5 in North Korea. And the officers that we hadn't seen were there playing baseball and basketball and football. And
wow.
And we had high jump and everything like that.
Huh. And the Chinese allowed this to happen.
They forced it to happen.
They wanted this to occur.
Right. And they had a minor Olympics in our camp and selected the people who were going to this Olympics of all the camps.
Wow. I suspect with your bum ankle that you didn't do too much of that, or had you healed up by then?
I had healed, and I actually won the high jump in our camp. But I did a flip off a horse that one of the guys had made and came down wrong and kind of rolled the arch back. So I couldn't jump, and I told the Chinese, "Take the guy that came in second and take him." "No, you won, you're going."
Oh, boy.
So I walked on the Yalu River up the river to take part in that Olympics.
Wow.
But all I could really do was watch.
Yeah, wow. Well, ultimately, that Jeep catches up with the convoy, and you and these other American prisoners are taken to safety. What was safety? Where did that convoy take you? Where did it drop you off?
At Panmunjom, there was a long bridge, and I guess at that time they were calling it Freedom Bridge or Bridge of No Return or something like that. And the Chinese brought us to that, and we got out of the trucks and walked across the bridge.
And on the other side of the bridge was Freedom.
Was a tent city.
Hmm.
We got in and got sprayed down with DDT and got new clothing, and then loaded on a helicopter and taken. I went to Incheon for a little while and then out to a ship.
Right. So you were then shipped home.
Right.
And by this point, the armistice has been signed, so the Korean conflict, for all intents and purposes, is over.
It's over.
Wow. Korean War veteran